Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
That third voice was
Bill Goodwin.
Bill is the investigations editor at Computer Weekly. Also with us is Sebastian Klovig.
Skelton.
But we'll just call you Seb.
Finally.
For the purpose of the tape. And these two guys have been working on a vein of stories about Facebook and privacy, that sort of thing. We're going to devote pretty much the whole of the podcast to that today, just as we devoted the last one to the moon landing. Did you all listen to that one?
Yeah.
I did. I listened to it at the time, live as well.
In 1969?
Yes.
Good for you, Bill. Should say, sorry for some of the sound quality on the last podcast, the moon one. That was some bizarre noises off.
Yeah, I was going to say it's probably down to aliens or maybe the people who believe the moon landing's never happened, just trying to shut that down.
Yeah, who were frequent contributors to Computer Weekly by way of commenting on Cliff's famous 2009 story, which has been such a terrific traffic generator ever since. Claire is on holiday this week, perhaps recovering from her ordeal, editing the last one. She'll be back on the next but one podcast. We're going to do two podcast recordings this week. Crazy, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's a bit much, but we will do it. And the next one, we're going to kind of circle back to government talk. We reviewed all the candidates for the Tory leadership in a set of podcasts, and we'll reflect on the first week of the new government and the next one. Alex, our networking editor, Alex Scroxton, will be in on that. I guess he'll probably update us on Huawei.
Oh, more than likely, yeah.
Which is the gift that has kept giving to the podcast for most of this year. So yeah, and at the end of this podcast, Caroline and I will do a very quick and dirty news review, just a couple of stories, and you're going to talk about numbers as well.
Yeah, all the cloud results that came out last week, AWS, Microsoft and Google primarily.
First, foremost, the main business of today is a little company called Facebook. Well, Seb, you've both been writing about this. How did you get into this vein of stories in the first place?
Wow, Facebook. Gosh, I'm really trying to minimise my use of Facebook now after writing these stories. So it's really quite scary. So what happened was there was a little company in America called 643 that produced an app. It's a very useful app designed to find your Facebook friends who are wearing bikinis.
Okay.
For a very useful app. But Facebook turned off their access to Facebook data, so they built an app specifically designed to integrate with Facebook. Facebook turned off their data, turned off a lot of other people's data as well, so they sued. And in the course of that legal action, Facebook released thousands of documents, which were highly confidential and placed under seal in a US court. Then the UK Parliament DCMS Committee, Select Committee, sent out the Sergeant at Arms to arrest the director of this little company, who happened to be in the UK, and demanded that he hand over these documents under threat of parliamentary contempt. Whatever that meant, it could have been very serious. He could have been jailed in a cell in Parliament. Or made to eat food in the canteen or whatever. So he handed them over. So round about the same time, through mechanisms we don't know, a similar set of documents was handed over to a chap who writes for Computer Weekly, investigative journalist Duncan Campbell. Mm. And he contacted me one Friday, late afternoon, and said, got this document for you about Facebook. And then we sort of published the first story late on a Friday night, and it got a crazy amount of attention.
It did, yeah. Tell us about that. It got picked up by the Nationals, got picked up in Europe.
Yeah. The stories that we've done have been picked up everywhere, so across the world. Yeah, I mean, virtually every country, probably between 30 and 60 different countries, They created a political storm in Ireland.
That's amazing.
Demands for inquiries and similar demands in Canada for inquiries. Yeah. So the next one happened on Sunday. I sent another document, and we decided to do that story with the very amazing Karen Cadwallader.
At The Observer.
At the Observer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she ran a story in The Observer, and we ran one simultaneously in Computer Weekly. That was about Facebook lobbying against GDPR.
Yeah.
Was that the George Osborne one? They tried to cozy up with him, didn't they?
Yeah, and offer some stuff for his kids or something really weird stuff, but they were doing it to politicians, kind of, not just people like George Osborne, but politicians kind of across Europe, North America. So it was pretty, global lobbying campaigns kind of in the name.
And this was in 2013?
But it's all kind of preempting the fact that GDPR, or I'm not sure if it was called GDPR at the time, or what was going to come down the line, they knew that it could quite drastically impact Facebook's business, didn't they? Or their ability to make money and stuff.
They did. So Sheryl Sandberg had a massive lobbying campaign at Davos in 2013. Mm. And, we got hold of the minutes of...
That was quite juicy, yeah.
Yeah, her record of who she spoke to and all the top politicians. She was using her book, Lean In, as a mechanism to get pally with some of the particularly female politicians in the European Commission, like Viviane Reding. It didn't always work.
I thought that was really interesting, actually, because it was seen as a very American thing, the way she was putting things to Viviane Reding about... getting women on boards and this kind of thing.
It didn't go down well with Viviane Reding at all. And, she was the minister, commissioner responsible for data protection, so that didn't work. But she did get on rather well with George Osborne and invited his son to come and visit Facebook offices and encouraged him to be even more vocal in speaking against GDPR.
Mm. Yeah.
In his opposition.
Did the son ever get his trip to the Facebook office?
Well, we never know. Well, George Osborne said not, so presumably not.
Of course, he's one of us now. He's a journalist. I mean, these people are not monsters, are they? They've just created something.
That has run away with itself, yes.
Yeah. Do you think it's a case of the road to hell is paved with good intentions, or... I mean, that's one way of seeing these people. They want to make the world a better place and connect people up.
Yeah.
Maybe at one point, but I think, like you said, it's kind of, maybe it does get carried away with them. Because I know one of the stories that we did on this was covering when there was a international grand committee held in Canada.
Yeah.
And one of the women testifying at that committee was Shoshana Zuboff, who wrote this book, Age of Surveillance, Capitalism. And she kind of talks about how all this stuff started developing kind of early 2000s, late 90s. So how Google kind of had all this excess data just from people using their search engine that they didn't really have any intention of using. And then from there, kind of dot-com bubble burst. So all of a sudden, Google and these companies have a pretty big interest in trying to monetize that data, which they had actually previously, and she documents this in a book, previously said they would never use for kind of advertising purposes, and that was in the late 90s. And then around the same time, I think you obviously have 9/11 happens, so a lot of NSA, CIA, a lot of state security apparatuses, if that's the correct plural, are also very interested in this kind of stuff. So nothing ever really gets done about it, and kind of 20 years later, now we're here. That's kind of my understanding of it, anyway, that makes the most sense of how we got here.
It's not just that our privacy has been annihilated by companies like Facebook and Google, which it has, but it's also, I think, more serious is the fact that this has been withheld from the public. It's been covered up, and companies like Facebook have behaved in a deceptive way towards the public. So they've used their data, but pretended otherwise and not been open about what they've been doing. So it's really the cover-up that's the bigger problem, I think.
Interesting.
And you mentioned at the start of this that, you know, you've kind of amended your how you use Facebook and things like that as a result of this. Have you done the same? First of all,
I deleted my Facebook and then had to get it back because I was like, I've got too many friends, I need to just be able to message. So I actually deleted it when I started working on this stuff and seeing generally how they behave. It made me quite uncomfortable being a user and consumer of their service. It's definitely use Instagram less as well.
Yeah, because that's
Facebook owned. So it's definitely had an impact.
And how have you amended yours then? Have you just sort of scaled back?
I don't really post anything very much personally. I post Facebook stories. That's about the only thing I do post. But I've discovered that for some reason people don't seem to be able to see them, so I rather suspect they're being blocked.
Oh really? Yeah. Oh, as a result of this?
Oh yeah.
Oh wow, okay, that's quite cool. So on the other side of this, because something we've talked about on previous podcasts as well, is that as we've kind of briefly touched on some of the reporting you guys have done on this topic, is that you've talked about cover up there and kind of bringing this to people's attention. So our kind of one of the questions we've posed on the podcast in the past is about what impact could this have on Facebook overall? Could there be like a sort of death by a thousand cuts as more revelations about it come out? And I think there's a reference made in one of the stories about how people are using Facebook less. You know, they're not posting as many stories anyway. Just, you know, they said, was it all posts are dying and stuff like that? So they need to find new ways of keeping people engaged.
That particular bit was about kind of around their IPO, which was May 2012. And it was in the internal documents. It was like an internal presentation. Around that time, they're kind of monitoring how people are using the site, and they notice a 63% drop in, I think it's specifically birthday posts on people's walls. But to them, that was a pretty good indicator of how much people are like logging onto the platform. And this was kind of in the period when they were transitioning from desktop to mobile, as a lot of kind of companies were in that period. So a lot of that was them, you know, figure out their business model as they were going along. And that's kind of what these documents then kind of cover that we got.
This idea that as more of these revelations come to light, do you anticipate this could lead to like maybe Facebook going the same way as MySpace and other platforms?
I think Facebook is in trouble. It's facing multiple investigations in multiple countries from multiple regulators.
Yeah.
So it's gonna have a difficult ride. It's facing another FTC investigation. The big question is some antitrust regulation and how that will be applied to it. That's one of the big questions. So it's possible that it's forced to divest itself of Instagram and WhatsApp. So there are questions over whether it's behaved in a proper way in over those acquisitions. There's been a lot of talk of splitting Facebook up, but possibly something that would be more useful would be to make it interoperable with other services. So you send a message on Facebook and it can arrive on some other messaging platform that isn't Facebook. And that would be a way of increasing competition. As Facebook is essentially a monopoly for advertising.
I was struck by a couple of sentences in one of your stories, guys. This is the story that's entitled Facebook's Privacy Game, How Zuckerberg Backtracked on Promises to Protect Personal Data. And there's a quote from your story. So just 3 years after its launch, Facebook had more than 50 million users and was on course to overtake its main rival, MySpace. The now emboldened Facebook quietly reneged on its promise not to track users when they visited other websites. I mean, I just wondered if from your reading of their point of view, is the narrative that they originally wanted to be the good guys in terms of privacy, and then they kind of went off the rails, and now their story is we're getting back on track and now we're going to value your privacy and so on. Because I know that Zuckerberg has talked about moving from a public square to a private living room mode and things like that.
Well, when they first started off, their selling point was that they were more private. They guarded your privacy more effectively than rivals. There was a lot of concern about MySpace and data leaking and whether children were safe using MySpace. So Facebook came along and said, you know, we absolutely won't track you. We won't use cookies to track you. your information is private. But when Facebook reached a sufficient scale and had a sufficient number of users, it didn't need to maintain that focus on privacy. It was able to backtrack quietly without telling people, and start introducing plugins and pieces of code that would monitor people even when they're outside Facebook. So they had this experiment with something called Beacon, that if you went to a retailer and bought something, it would automatically put a post saying, Brian's just bought a very nice bottle of malt whiskey from this malt whiskey shop, for example.
Something that frequently happens, but yes.
But people were finding that, you know, things that they wanted to keep private were being posted on Facebook. It was very hard to opt out. One poor chap, a guy called Sean Lane, has gone down in history because he bought his wife a diamond ring, and the purchase was posted on Facebook. Within 5 minutes, his wife rang up and said, "What's going on?" Mm-hmm. You know, completely ruined his Christmas.
She found out that, like, he'd actually bought it for someone else and the marriage was over that way or something.
That's a story.
Yeah.
That would have been
that is what I was thinking
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, like,
that would have been a good story. Maybe he had. So they scrapped that, and then they did the same thing again with something called the like button.
Which seems like such a fabulous thing. You can like things. What's not to like about liking?
Mm.
Well, what they didn't tell people was that the like button also tracked your movements and tracked which websites you were looking at. And a couple of American researchers did some investigation and found that the like button would track you even if you were not a member of Facebook. It would still send data back to Facebook saying what websites you've visited. Mm. So Facebook had denied this was happening and said, well, okay, yes, all right, it is sending data back, but we're not actually using it. But eventually it was forced to disable some of the tracking features. Mm. So there's a pattern, you know, introducing technology that tracks people, being found out and then having to backtrack.
That's probably worth noting as well, that pattern has existed for a long time. So in that story where we go through the 22 examples of where Facebook kind of violated promises or backtracked on kind of privacy promises, the first one was from 2006. You know, that was only when Facebook was 2 years old. So it's fairly well ingrained behavior. I think there's a tendency to think, oh, this just kind of started with Cambridge Analytica almost.
Yeah. Well, anyone who's seen the Social Network film will know that the origins of Facebook are somewhat tainted in terms of that original website that he built. Was it the FaceMash?
Yeah.
Comparing students at Harvard, boys as well as girls, I think, but it was mostly hot or not, can I say?
Yeah.
It's a pretty scuzzy thing to do.
Mm.
That does seem to have manifested itself, or has it, through the history of Facebook? I mean, do we think this company is any more evil than Google or Amazon? Or?
I don't know that, but the thing you mentioned earlier, that sort of almost like the wheels coming off a bit, the IPO seems quite instrumental in it, and I don't know if I've interpreted this wrong from all the reporting, but it does seem like suddenly from that point onwards, things, maybe they're questionable behaviour seems to have ramped up a bit. I don't know if that is a fair assessment.
I think it goes back to kind of what I mentioned earlier about Google and their whole surveillance capitalism model after the dot-com bubble. I think it was there, they were kind of collecting the data, but now they had the financial incentive, because that IPO was bad. I think investors lost something like $40 billion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, there's a direct financial incentive at that point to kind of switch up the business model and start being a bit more, I'm going to go with the word ruthless, with how they use people's data.
Mm.
And they're super focused on targeting. So they don't really care about content as such, as long as it targets.
So if you go on the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, and look at Facebook's filings with them year on year, it shows you, if you go and kind of read through them, what percentage of Facebook's revenue is from advertising, and it's always been high, but the past couple of years especially, it's been kind of like 97-98% of Facebook's entire revenue. So for that to happen, their business model is completely predicated on them taking your data, repackaging it, and then selling it to businesses.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook is always claimed correctly that it doesn't sell data, but what it does do is sell analysis of your data. So it'll allow advertisers to target people that they want to target with certain profiles, and it has a huge amount of information on everyone. I think it's at least 50 data points on everyone. It can target people very precisely.
And what's the user base now? Is it 2.4 billion? That's quite...
It's massive. It's definitely over 2.2 billion for sure, because I see kind of varying estimates at various times. But yeah, it's in that kind of ballpark. It's absolutely huge.
So if it were a state, it would be twice the size of China.
Never thought about it that way, but yeah, it would be, yeah.
It's a big thing.
But I mean, on that point, it's probably worth pointing out again that's what gives the data the power as well, is that they have so much of it. Like, so for example, my data points are absolutely meaningless to Facebook, but it's when they can kind of correlate them and collect it and analyze it in comparison to, the 2+ billion other people's data that they have, it suddenly becomes very effective.
And if this new currency that they're launching, Libra, actually takes off, then you'll have financial information as well as social.
Well, Facebook say that they won't have access to that financial data.
Do we believe them?
I mean, given the 22 examples we've been through where they have backtracked on promises, it's meaningless. Completely meaningless. I guess only time will tell, but I think it's pretty safe to say at this point that, Facebook can't actually be trusted. And that's the view of, not just us having done these stories, that's like, lawmakers and people in positions of quite a lot of power.
But that's quite new. I mean, the fact that it's not trusted, was that the case 10 years ago? Not so sure.
As a Facebook user of as long ago as that, I think you have definitely seen a change in how people use the platform. But I say the level of detail and personal insight and information that people are sharing on it has also gone right down, which is to me what was also quite interesting about why they purchased WhatsApp, because the kind of conversations I used to be having on Facebook quite openly on my wall have moved into group chats now that are private, away from kind of public gaze. So I think what Bill said earlier, they have to divest stuff off. If they have to leave WhatsApp, I think that would be potentially quite damaging.
Yeah, so it's interesting how Facebook came to buy WhatsApp, because they were monitoring rival apps using using a VPN that they encourage people to download. They encourage people to download a VPN to keep their data safe on their mobile phones, while secretly using it to monitor what apps they were using on their mobile phones. So they had this huge database of the most popular apps, and one of them was WhatsApp, far more popular than the Facebook messaging app, and that was a big concern. They were really trying to work out how to get people to use Messenger.
Interesting.
In the end, they decided to buy WhatsApp.
Mm. Is that something that you read in these documents? Or something that you know from public data?
It's something that is contained within the documents, yes.
On that point, there were entire kind of documents within the collection of documents that were like, I guess they were like tables. So one thing that Facebook had was this start program called FB Start, and they were using this Anavo data to kind of monitor startups to decide whether or not they were competitive threats and whether they would, and this is in the columns, bootstrap or accelerate them. So they were using this to kind of, track, and that's startups for a specific program they were doing, but they also, it's in the documents that are leaked, it's for all kinds of apps that they were using this for, to kind of, I guess, scope out the competition and see who was a threat and who wasn't. And I think that kind of coloured a lot of their decisions based on who got access to their data, their APIs and these kinds of things.
There were some quite, I suppose, cynical discussions amongst some of the execs over privacy. So, you know, people were worried, one of the execs was worried about enterprising journalists who might look into a particular update and then discover that this update allowed Facebook to upload their SMS messages and their phone call records into Facebook. Big concern. Not that it was being done, but that someone might find out about it. Mm. And I think in the end, they found a way of installing the update whilst avoiding a permission screen, so you didn't have to give permission.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
For this facility to be added. But later on, people downloaded their Facebook data and discovered records of their call histories with their aunties and uncles and...
Metadata, though, which is perfectly harmless. They are a fiendish bunch, it seems.
Well, metadata is...
From these stories.
Metadata is a lot more useful than the content.
It's very useful, yeah. Yeah. It's very useful indeed. I don't know, so where are you going to go with this story, do you think? You've got there's a lot more to come.
Yeah, there's a lot more to come. We're just carrying on working on it. I'm going to take a bit of a break over August.
Yeah, you've got two things to do over the summer.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
The other stuff you've got to work on, is that still based on those documents, or has there been other sort of spin-off sort of reports that come out of the back of this work?
Well, both really. There's plenty more documents to read through and analyse. We're not short of material. Yeah.
Have you had any reaction from them, or maybe reaction from readers? Some comments on the stories? Or?
I mean, the reaction from Facebook itself is always the same.
Has Ned Clegg been in touch to reassure you?
You should be on first name. Surely,
but no, dealing with Facebook on a kind of on a PR level is basically like dealing with like the Met Police. It's like trying to make a stone bleed. Like you can't do it. They're just going to give you some kind of boilerplate answer, and that's pretty much the standard of what you get from Facebook, to be honest.
I think it's had possibly more impact on some of our partners we're working with. So we're working with NBC in the States.
Okay.
And I think Facebook were quite concerned to find out how NBC got hold of its information. So they put in a court request to search the records of 643's lawyers to see if there are any communications between NBC named people and named journalists that we worked with in the lawyers' communications. And so, you know, Carol Cadwallader and Duncan Campbell are also search terms in the court order.
Mm.
So they seem to be more concerned about the sort of US coverage than Computer Weekly's coverage, I think.
Seb, I remember you telling me about something you discovered, some court case in the US where the lawyer said something.
Oh yeah, no, this was in Law 360, I think.
Yeah.
It was... So the Facebook's lawyer's name was Oren Snyder, and it was in a US district court, and he arguing, you know, defending Facebook, and this was a kind of a, I think it was a class action lawsuit over, well, one of the many running over the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and he actually said the words, privacy wasn't broken, and in quote, because there is no privacy. Like, this is a guy this year, a couple of months ago, arguing that to a US district court judge as an actual defense. He said, we didn't break any expectations of privacy because there was no privacy.
On Facebook.
Yeah, on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that's how that got through the Facebook bureaucracy.
Mm.
I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he still has a job, to be honest, because that's a...
Yeah. It's an incredible statement.
Yeah.
It's an incredible admission. It really is. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating story. Bill, you in particular, you've been working for Computer Weekly since the late 90s. So you're in a good position to answer this question, which I'm going to It's a fairly obvious one for me. I mean, a lot of our readers will be IT managers and so on, IT professionals. I mean, for them, is this type of story just intrinsically interesting or general interest, or is there anything that helps their professional kind of lives with this kind of story?
Well, I think this story is a good case study in how not to manage and process data.
Right.
So, you know, everyone is interested in data and data analytics, and it's used in across every company in marketing. So everyone is trying to collect data. And
yeah, lots of companies want to be data-driven, don't they? And yeah. I suppose this is a textbook example of perhaps not how not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's a fabulously successful company.
It's fabulously successful. You could argue that here is an example of how to do it and get away with it, you know. depending on how you...
I suppose that could be useful to some...
How you look at it.
Some type of IT professional. Indeed.
But then Facebook themselves have been trying to get into the enterprise, but with their workplace application as well, haven't they? So there's an element of that. Should you be wary of what would they do with once they get hold of your corporate data?
Yeah. I think given all the kind of money they've got coming in from advertising to consumers, they might never really need to.
Yeah.
To get too excited about that, and if they're going to launch their own currency, I mean, they're effectively a kind of state.
So the kind of behavioural analytics that they sell on us based on the data that we give them, that's only sold to other enterprises already.
Mm.
We can't buy that off Facebook. There's no option for me to go and buy someone's data so I can...
No, we're not customers. We're the product.
But the customers are enterprises.
Yeah,
right?
The customers are enterprises.
You could probably buy advertisements on Facebook, I think.
Sure. Mm. But then I guess I don't have the purchasing power to be kind of, you know, paying Facebook's fees to get the in-depth kind of data that a lot of enterprises do want on consumers.
Facebook's users are the product, they're not the customers or Facebook.
One of the issues that came up was that Facebook can allow companies to target adverts in quite a discriminatory way. There's a case going on in the States about this, about housing, so possible to advertise housing to only white people, or to exclude ethnic minorities, or, you know, to exclude particular stratas of society or people with particular political views. So it does facilitate quite discriminatory advertising. So we'll see what happens with that.
That sounds very interesting indeed. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you do hear about the filter bubble phenomenon, that you only really get to read things by people who agree with you. But I mean, that's very insidious. Yeah, that kind of targeting. So they wanted to make the world a better place and connect people. And what have they created?
Yeah. Well, Mark Zuckerberg's response is to reposition the company as privacy focused. So privacy is the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very clever, because what they're doing really is what Facebook has done all along, which is gather more data into itself, so sharing less data with app developers. It's been cutting off data for a long time from app developers. It's built up the ecosystem of apps that work on Facebook, got to a big enough size. Commercially, it didn't need those app developers. For commercial reasons, it's been cutting off their access to data. But presenting it as a move towards privacy, and the so-called pivot to privacy is really an extension of that. It's really about Facebook gathering more data and keeping it to itself. It will allow private communications, but the content of the communications of no value to Facebook, so the fact that it knows that who my contacts are and how often I contact them is valuable. So Facebook doesn't need to read my messages. It can quite legitimately offer to keep my messages entirely private, but the metadata is very commercially useful.
Speaking of data, as we have been doing, and just thank you very much, guys. I mean, that's fantastic. It's a real ongoing tour de force that you're both writing, and there's clearly a lot of detail in there, and you brought out things that I didn't see as well. So thank you very much indeed. for doing that, Caroline, and we're just going to do a very quick skip through a couple of stories. There were in the e-zine that drops today, actually. So one is the spectre of a no-deal Brexit. The House of Commons Committee for Exiting the European Union has warned, surprise, surprise, that leaving the EU without a deal would disrupt supply chains and data sharing. It's a scenario that will generate the need for a lot of IT work to be done and so on and so forth. It's going to be very chaotic. On the other hand, we're reassured our new government is turbocharging the arrangements for leaving without a deal. So there's that one.
Mm.
Also, Jeremy Wright was a victim of the cull last week, enacted by Boris Johnson on becoming Prime Minister. The former Secretary of State at DCMS, Jeremy Wright, who was also a contributor to Computer Weekly.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably the most important thing about him, in some ways.
Was that last week, the opinion thing he said?
Yeah, that he was very keen to get that one in, yeah. And, you know, it seemed like a decent enough bloke, and we were glad to have his contributions to CW, but he's gone.
Yeah, that's it. We need to get it published quite quickly, because we don't know whether or not
he would still be in his position
by the time it got published otherwise.
But I mean, lots of people got eliminated last week, sent to the backbenches, including Jeremy Hunt. And all those other people whose biographies we trogged through to find out if they had any remote tangential connection to technology. But we'll come on to that in the next podcast. And you said there were some numbers, the cloud behemoth.
Yeah, it's been I think we're in the middle again of the summer slowdowns we've referenced on podcasts. But last week was a big week in terms of all the various cloud giants releasing their numbers and stuff like that. And probably the most notable thing about it is that for a long time now, we've talked about on Computer Weekly about how AWS in particular seems to be bucking the trend of big numbers in terms of the fact that as it's getting bigger, its growth rate should slow down, and it hasn't. And ahead of their numbers coming out each quarter, analysts always said, oh, this will be the quarter where they start to show a dip, and it hasn't happened. But then it has now. It happened in last week's results. I think they reported a 37% annual growth rate, which sounds pretty good to me. But up until that point, they'd been hovering around sort of the mid-40s, nearing sort of 50% growth rate, and now it's just started to tail off, which is... I say 37% growth is still quite a nice amount of growth to have. But those results have been seized on quite a lot by industry commentators around, is this sort of a sign that maybe with AWS being so prevalent, they don't like us using the word dominant, remember, they're just prevalent in cloud. Is this going to provide a way in for like Microsoft to steal some share off them because their growth rate is sort of on the up and up at the moment? And the same for Google as well. But it's just lots of... year-on-year percentage there. So it's all numbers, but yeah, that's probably the biggest trend in amongst them all last week.
We may come back to that again in our next recording, which will be very soon.
Yes, yeah, about 3 days,
So that's probably all we've got time for today. We've all got day jobs to get back to, and these guys have got more investigative work to do on Facebook. Thank you very much again, Bill and Seb, for guesting on the podcast today. Very much appreciated.
And thanks for having us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Our pleasure.
I'm giving a thumbs up sign, but you can't see it because it's on the podcast.
You're liking it. And thank you to you, Caroline, as usual. And thanks for listening. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.